I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, awards season is here. We're going to take a closer look at the Oscar nominees and this year's winning children's books. That conversation is just ahead. But first, we want to head to Africa, where there is deadly violence in Africa's most populous country. Coordinated bombings in Nigeria killed more than 150 people late last week in Kano, which is Nigeria's second largest city. Islamist militants known as Boko Haram claimed responsibility for last week's bombings, and there are now fresh reports of violence there. The Boko Haram are also thought to be behind other attacks over the last few months, including a very serious and deadly bombing on Christmas Day. The bloodshed comes after mass protests across the country when the government removed a fuel subsidy. That decision caused the price of gasoline and other products to skyrocket. We wanted to try to unravel this very complicated story, so we've called upon Tim Cox. He's Reuters' chief correspondent for Nigeria. He joins us by phone from Lagos, Nigeria. Also with us once again, Dr. Mwangi Kimenyi. He is the director of the Africa Growth Initiative at the Brookings Institution, and he was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studio. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
So, Tim Cox, I'm going to start with you and just ask you to bring us up to date on the latest. We understand that there are new reports of violence in Nigeria. What's going on?
Today there hasn't actually been unconfirmed reports of more violence, but really there's still very much a case of a body count going on for Friday's attack, which was by far the deadliest single strike that Boko Haram have managed to achieve to date. I think that certainly it looks as if the violence is only going to get worse, at least in the short term. And the general perception is that President Goodluck Jonathan's administration and his security forces just seem at the moment completely incapable of dealing with the situation in the north and haven't really fully grasped, or perhaps not until this weekend, the gravity of the crisis there. I would say that probably this could actually be a turning point. For the first time, President Jonathan went to visit the victims of the bombing in Kano. Normally, he's been very, very dismissive. After a bombing, he'll wait a few hours. He'll put out some statement that usually doesn't seem to be taking it all very seriously and just telling Nigerians, well, that this is just some terrorist thing. This is an insurgency that will fizz out. I think he's starting to realize quite how serious the situation is.
I understand that as serious as this bombing was, it could even have been worse, because I understand that the police say that they found 10 cars packed with what are being described as unexploded devices, that some cars were found abandoned. So as bloody as it was, it could even have been worse. Tim, is that what I'm hearing?
It could have been much worse, because and I suppose some limited credit does go to the security forces here for managing to find those. There were cars loaded with explosives. They also found there were several coke cans loaded with relatively high-grade explosives that the police have seized from various locations, which would presumably have gone off at some stage. Whether to read that as that, you know, this event could have been worse, or whether this is just the tip of the iceberg and it just shows quite how dangerous Kano is becoming is difficult to say. But certainly the security forces there have been knocked out of any kind of complacency they had.
Mwangi Kimenyi, can you tell us, what is this group? And what are their goals? What are they after? What is the purpose of this?
This is what I would consider a radicalized Muslim group that has become increasingly violent. It sees itself as the intent of overthrowing the government of Nigeria, which it considers a forbidden government. They consider that anything that's not Islam is not right. And therefore, it has gained a lot of organizational capacity. It's gaining more support. But I think the bigger problem is that it has been underestimated by the government of Nigeria.
And what is their ultimate goal? Is it to partition the country into an Islamic north and a Christian south? Is it to control or impose Islamic law in the entire country? Have they ever made clear a specific objective?
They say that they want a state that is an Islam state, but they are not talking about north or south. They are talking about Nigeria. So they are not talking just partitioning north or south. They think that anything that is Western is not right, and therefore they would like a different type of government.
And the name of the group means what?
Well, it's actually more than what it said. It talks about the Western education is forbidden. But actually, it is a bigger term that anything that is not Islam is not correct. It's a longer term, but it's been shortened to this idea of the Western education not being right or acceptable.
If you just tuned in, we're talking about recent turmoil in Nigeria. I'm joined by Mwangi Kimenyi. He's with the Brookings Institution. That's a research institute here in Washington, D.C. Also with us, Tim Cox. He's Reuters chief correspondent in Nigeria, and he's with us from there. Now, Tim, we also talked about the fuel subsidy, that the government decided to remove a fuel subsidy. Nigeria is, of course, a major oil-producing country. And that caused the price of not just gasoline, but all sorts of products to skyrocket, you know, bus tickets, food, anything that has to be transported. Tim Cox, you've covered this issue extensively. What was the rationale for removing this fuel subsidy? And is it in any way related to the other story that we talked about, the violence?
Well, the clear link between, though they're obviously very different things, this issue of Boko Haram and the anger over the fuel subsidy removal. What came out from these protests that I think connects the two is that both were motivated by a general anger at the government, at what Nigerians see as decades of misrule, of corruption, of failure to deliver even the most basic services, despite pumping something like 2 million barrels of oil every day, which, as far as most people can see, and especially in the north where this insurgency started, hasn't really done much to better their lives. In fact, they say they suffer more insecurity, they suffer higher prices, and they get nothing back. The one thing that they thought they did get back was this fuel subsidy. Of course, it was not actually a direct benefit from the oil, because the oil is all exported crude, and then they have to import refined fuel very expensively. That's because the refineries here are completely defunct. But it was always seen as a kind of red line that you can't cross. Maybe you fail to provide us with education, health, roads, and everything else, but at the very least, let us keep this cheap fuel. The reason the government now wants to get rid of it, and many people think it's actually a very sensible idea, is that it's a huge cost on the budget. It's extremely inefficient. It's very corrupt. It basically hands over billions of dollars of Nigerian treasury money to a cartel of fuel importers who fix prices and then smuggle a lot of the fuel to other countries anyway. So the actual economic logic of getting rid of the subsidy was very, very sensible, but the anger that it unleashed was motivated as much by this feeling that despite pumping all this oil, that people's lives are no better than they were in the 1960s. And very much that's what kind of connects it to Boko Haram, because if you look at the north, the north is very, very poor. You know, they do get their allocation of the oil money, but the all this sort of wealth and power and increasingly power is concentrated in the south. And northerners are very resentful about that. And with the sort of level of high youth unemployment that you have in places like Kano and Maiduguri, it's very easy for someone like Boko Haram to find recruits. So I'd say that's the thing that connects the two.
Very briefly, Tim, can you just tell us, what is your sense of the mood of the country right now?
Yeah, the overall mood, it's pretty sour at the moment. There's a feeling that the current administration isn't able to guarantee people security, that it hasn't really delivered on other promises like sorting out electricity, and that it's not going to be able to as long as it has this huge security headache to deal with. Increasingly, especially in the north, people are becoming very, very fearful that this low-level insurgency is actually escalating into something much bigger, much nastier, and that it's actually potentially going to bring the country to the brink of something like a civil war, though nobody really thinks that, you know, a full-on military conflict splitting the country is that likely. The mood is pretty it's pretty downbeat at the moment.
And Mwangi Kimenyi, I'm going to give you the last word. You follow events not just in Nigeria, but throughout the continent. And what are you most concerned about with the situation in Nigeria right now?
Well, maybe if I comment very briefly on the oil subsidies, it's something that makes the removal of subsidies is something that makes economic sense. But it's very, politically, it's a very volatile situation. Nigeria is spending about 5% of its GDP on subsidies. That's a huge expenditure. It's not sustainable. That's one of the places where you also find that you queue for fuel, although you are a major producer of oil, because refineries cannot be, they cannot be kept in good order if the infrastructure is not maintained, because most of these resources is going to these subsidies. So it's not sustainable. However, the way you do these type of situations is, I think that was the problem, is immediate removal of the subsidies. There should have been a well thought out, a better way of doing it, gradual and so on. Now, what does it all mean? You have the Boko Haram, you have the you have these protests against subsidies. Nigeria is a major country in West Africa and in Africa. This is likely to destabilize Nigeria, but it's also going to impact other economies in the area. So the concern is that problems in Nigeria are likely to spill over to other economies. So that's a real issue.
And finally, is there any role that you think the U.S. should be playing right now?
Well, I think in the area of the Boko Haram, maybe issue of more training, counterinsurgency. But let's remember, this group, the northern part of Nigeria, consider itself marginalized. There has to be, even when you use military force, you need also to use other economic programs, investments, more education, and all that. So it's beyond just fighting the terrorist group. It needs also to think about their economic well-being. And the U.S. can assist there. And it's important for U.S. also, because if this group continues to grow in strength, it's going to join these other terrorist groups. It's going to be a headache to Africa. It's going to be a headache to the international community.
Mwangi Kimenyi is director of the Africa Growth Initiative at the Brookings Institution. That's a research institute in the Washington, D.C. area. He was here with us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Tim Cox is Reuters chief correspondent for Nigeria, and he was kind enough to join us by phone from his office there in Lagos. Thank you both so much for speaking with
Thank
us.
Thank you, Michelle. We appreciate it.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, when you are looking for selections for your child's library or for gifts for the other little people in your life, you may have looked for books with that gold or silver sticker from the American Library Association. It's their seal of excellence, if you will. Well, their picks for best kids books came out yesterday, and we will speak with one of the winners a bit later in the program. And if you're looking to fill the toy box, we will be talking about why toys are so often marketed to either boys or girls, and we'll talk about whether it has to be that way. That's our parenting conversation. But first, grab your popcorn. The Academy Award nominations were announced today. Joining us to talk about which movies and actors shined and who got left on the cutting room floor is Wesley Morris. He's a film critic with the Boston Globe. Welcome back, Wesley. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
Hello. How are you?
Well, I'm better now that I'm talking to you about this.
Aww.
Even though it always makes me feel bad because I'm thinking about all the films that I missed, because you still won't babysit like I keep asking you. Come over so I can catch up.
You keep bringing that up.
I know. Well, let's start big. Let's start big. The Martin Scorsese picture Hugo had the most nominations with 11, including, of course, for Best Picture. What's so special about this film?
You tell me, Michelle.
Oh, no.
I mean, that's not fair. Martin Scorsese's movie it's good. The people who love this movie, they really love it. My problem with it is basically that it's about film preservation, and it's one of Martin Scorsese's pet projects. He loves that, and I think it's a beautiful thing to want us to care about. And it's an interesting way, using the story of a kid and his mysterious man that he finds working in a train station is a great vehicle for that. It's just not a timeless movie to me. It feels very much, it's not political, but from a cinematic standpoint, it kind of is. It's sweet, but pointed in a way. And I think that people who love this movie kind of love its innocence.
But you don't think it's all that.
I don't think it's all that.
All right.
You've seen better from our friend Martin Scorsese.
Well, we'll see. And another one of the big winners was The Artist with 10 nominations. Mm-hmm. And I would play a clip, but it was a silent film. And
We just won't say anything.
But it was reported that by the Telegraph in the UK that some people walked out of the theater and requested refunds because they didn't realize it was a silent film. So tell me what you thought.
What is wrong with people?
I don't understand.
They don't read your reviews ahead of time.
That would break Harvey Weinstein's heart, since he's pouring a lot of money into trying to get people to see it and understand why they're there. You know, this is a movie. You know, what's interesting about these nominations to me is that there is a kind of return to some distant era. You know, Scorsese's movie is set in a train station, you know, many, many, many decades ago. The artist is set during the silent era and is itself a silent movie. And I think people, the resistance with the artist, I think if people are resisting it, I think it's that they're being told it's something they should want to see without actually having had the opportunity to sort of decide whether they want to see it on their own. So it takes on this medicinal quality that I think kind of harms it in the public's eye, I think.
Well, that's interesting because there's one more film that we want to talk about where that criticism is being made. It's not nominated yet because it just came out. So let's hold that thought for a minute. We're talking about the Oscar nominations that were just announced today. My guest is Wesley Morris, film critic for the Boston Globe. All right, well, let's talk about the women who shined on the screen, The Help. Very controversial film. It's one of those polarizing films. You got to kind of tread lightly before you ask your friends about whether they liked it or not.
Did you notice that we took a deep breath before you even said, yeah.
Four nominations. Here's a clip featuring Best Actress nominee Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer, who's a nominee for Best Supporting Actress. And worth mentioning that Octavia Spencer's already been honored by the Golden Globe. So here it is.
Hold on, those are Miss Hillis. She looked like the winning horse at the Kentucky Derby. All
them
flowers and bows.
Got that paprika on them.
Oh. Forgive me, Lord, but I'm going to have to kill that woman, Abilene. Now she going to put pencil marks on the toilet paper.
Did you?
Mm-hmm. But I carry paper in from my own damn house. That fool don't know.
Now, okay, deep breath. This is a film that was based on the best-selling novel on the bestseller list for just weeks and weeks and weeks, if it isn't still there, about sort of telling the story of African-American maids in the kind of the civil rights era and kind of their story and how.
Yeah, I mean, look, you just played that clip and my eyes kind of welled up a little bit because there's two ways to go about feeling about this movie. The one is the movie itself and, like, what those two women do to you. And Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer are really good in this movie. I think they'll both win, by the way. But, you know, then you have the sort of meta problem, which is what they're doing in this movie and what else you've seen Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer do this year. And this was it. These were the two biggest parts for any actress in any movie for any black actress in any movie all last year. And you kind of have to ask yourself in 2010 or 2011, 2012, why that persists. That's always been my question with this movie.
Yes. And that's one of those deeper conversations that people either get it or they
it
don't.
Is.
You know what I mean? It's
but,
one of those conversations
you know
people
what?
Either get it or they don't. Worth mentioning, Jessica Chastain was also nominated for Best Supporting Actress. So, you know,
she's really good in that movie, too. And she, amazingly enough, she could have not made the cut because she had six movies that she was eligible for last year.
But that tells you something, doesn't it? Whereas Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer do not.
Michelle, so, it's a different show.
There it is. A long one. As for Best Actor, George Clooney, nominated for The Descendants, who, as expected, he also was just honored by the Golden Globes. This is a very beautiful, interesting movie out of Hawaii. But we only have a minute left, so I want to talk about Demian Bashir, who starred as an illegal immigrant in A Better Life.
Yes.
It was a bit of a surprise for some people.
It's been a building surprise, but when the Screen Actors Guild nominated him, you know, a couple months ago, you know, it began to make people open their eyes and say, whoa, what is going on there? What are people seeing in this movie that nobody saw?
What is it that you think people saw? As we mentioned, it's about an illegal immigrant who's trying to figure out how to stay in this country so he can take care of his son.
Well, it's
what
not just any. He's a gardener in Los Angeles. And this is no pun intended. It's in people's backyards. And this guy is telling a story that a lot of the people who are in the academy have deal with in some way because they hire guys like this to work for them. And he's trying to live the American dream, so to speak. And it takes a horrible turn. It's a very quiet, dignified performance. He's really good. I'm shocked they noticed it.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. Wesley Morris, film critic for the Boston Globe. He joined us from Boston. Wesley, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Now we'll talk prizes for a different type of storytelling, children's books. And you might remember those special books in your school library, the ones with the shiny gold, silver, or bronze seals. Those books were winners of the John Newbery Medal or Randolph Caldecott Medal for excellent writing and illustrations in children's books. The awards are given out each year by the American Library Association. That group also gives out prizes for children's books aimed at telling stories that reveal the diversity of the American experience, including the Coretta Scott King Awards, recognizing African-American writers and illustrators. And we are very pleased to be joined now by Kadir Nelson. He is the author and illustrator of Heart and Soul, The Story of America and African-Americans. It won this year's King Award for Writing. Also with us, Crystal Carr Jeter. She is the Coretta Scott King Book Awards Committee Chair. Welcome to you both. Thank you so much for joining us. And of course, Mr. Nelson, congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for asking.
So, Mr. Nelson, this is your second King honor. You won the 2008 prize for We Are the Ship, the story of Negro League Baseball. And I just wanted to ask, where were you when you found out? What happens? Do you get a call, a letter? How does it work?
Well, the calls are made very early in the morning, so I was sleeping. And I was wondering who was calling me so early from Dallas, because I don't really know anyone from Dallas. But to my surprise and delight, it was the Coretta Scott King Committee informing me that my book had been given the prize. So it was a really pleasant awakening.
Now, Crystal Carr Jeter, you spent your career as a children's librarian, and you consult with Cleveland's public library, so presumably you see a lot of books. What does your committee look for in deciding whom to bestow these awards upon?
Well, first of all, the Coretta Scott King Book Awards honors African-American authors and illustrators of outstanding books for children and young adults. They are looking for titles that promote understanding and appreciation of all people, but particularly affect the lives of African Americans. And we want to commemorate, based on the title, we commemorate the life of Dr. Martin Luther King, and it also honors Mrs. King in continuing her work. We're looking for books that are distinguished.
Now, they're not all about history. This year, the books tended to, if I have this right, from just looking at the list of award winners, tended to have a strong Black history theme. They covered issues like slavery and the Northern migration and things of that sort. Do you generally prefer historical books, or are there other types of books that have won?
No, we do cover the gamut. We look at the African American experience, past, present, and future, but we don't always look at historical events. Sometimes we look at arts and cultural events, family. Music, those kinds of things are all important.
You know, Mr. Nelson, you know, your book covers a very difficult period, including slavery. I mean, some very difficult subjects, if you're going to tell the truth about it. And you've also, I should mention that you worked on the feature film Amistad, which dealt with this in a fairly graphic way. And I'm wondering how you decided or what choices you made in thinking about how to talk about this with children, because this is easily the kind of thing that could give children nightmares. I mean, don't you agree?
Certainly. I mean, parts of our history is very scary. But when I look at American history and I look at what history means to me, I look at it as if it were a string of stories. And if it's told well enough and in a way that's charming and warm and with wit and humor, then it takes a bit of the edge off of it. You can still tell the truth, but if you tell it very sweetly and very warmly, it makes it go down a bit easier.
We're talking with author Kadir Nelson. He's the winner of this year's Coretta Scott King Writing Prize for Children's Literature. Also with us is Crystal Carr Jeter. She's the chair of the Coretta Scott King Awards Committee. Ms. Crystal Carr Jeter, tell me, what made this book an award winner?
The book covers all of the criteria that we look at. We look at an original work. We look at established standards of well-drawn characters. We look at the writing style. We look at the mesh of the art and the text together. We look at authenticity of the African-American experience. And all of these things were embodied in Heart and Soul.
And, of course, Mr. Nelson, you're known just for your amazing illustrations, just kind of lush, distinctive. You know, would you agree with me, Ms. Carr Jeter, that you could pick a Kadir Nelson book if it was, you know, 10 feet away, you could pick it out?
Absolutely, I'm a true fan, and he knows that.
But what do you think? Can I get your take on this whole question, though, of the difficulty of these topics? You know, as we are getting more and more removed, at least for some people, from experiencing, you know, the harshness.
Yes.
The hardest edges of the Black experience. You know, I can imagine that there are some people saying, well, does my child really need to be exposed to this, especially as a child? I mean, couldn't this wait till high school or something like that? I mean, what is your take on that?
No, no, no. Even at a young age, I think it's important to try to open up their lives to American history, and particularly because of our book award, the lives of African American history. We want to give them a full focus, a full viewpoint. And I think one of the things that we enjoyed so much about Heart and Soul is that it's told from a familial position, from an elderly viewpoint, looking back over the life. It had a very storytelling point of view. This is the way he focused the point. And it wasn't told in a scary point of view that you were bringing up. It was sort of, this is what has happened to us, and this is how we have built not only our own culture, but the whole American culture, how we've been a part of it.
Going back to the question I asked you earlier about the fact that this year's books, award winners, tend to focus on history and themes out of African American history, is it your sense that these stories are not yet fully integrated into the historical curriculum of all students?
Actually, I think that's exactly right. In fact, I think that's one of the growing trends we're going to see in children's literature, that some of the beautiful titles and books that are coming out now about the American experience are correcting some of the misinterpretations or the mistakes that have been in history before, and that we are being able right now with titles like Heart and Soul and the other ones that we have been given awards to show exactly authentic and accurate portrayals of our history.
Kadir Nielsen, who do you hope will pick up one of your books?
I write books like Heart and Soul and We Are the Ship for all age groups. I'm certainly cognizant of the fact that children are going to be reading it, and I hope that, again, librarians and teachers who are sharing history with the children, that they'll be able to use books like these to help supplement their curriculum, because often African-American history has been treated in our history textbooks as a sidebar, and hopefully books like these will be used by teachers and parents in home to help share these really powerful stories.
Ms. Carr-Jeter, I wanted to ask you that the Coretta Scott King Awards is only one of the awards given out by the American Library Association. The Pura Belpre Awards recognize Latino authors or Latina authors who've written about the Latino experience. And the Schneider Family Awards recognizes excellence in highlighting the experience of being disabled and others.
Yes.
And I'm asking you, and I'm wondering, do you foresee a time when there will not be a need for these various distinct categories? Or do you think that they have their own merit regardless?
No, I think that they all have a place. I think that it is important, though, to be able to see the titles that we are honoring in our various cultural awards also get the other awards, like the Caldecott or the Newbery, those kind of things. I'd like to see the crossing of titles, because literature for children shouldn't be limited. It should be across all categories. But I do think awards like the Coretta Scott King Book Awards should still be there. It should always have a place. I think it's important to be able to single out and be able to focus on a particular area.
Well, Kadir Nielsen, let me just thank you once again. Thank you both for coming, and also congratulate you once again on your second Coretta Scott King Award. Can we persuade you to give us a hint about your next project?
I'll give you a little hint. It's actually a big hint. It's a book on Nelson Mandela. It's a picture book biography of his life. It'll be due next fall.
Oh, well, we will look forward to that. All right.
Too.
Kadir Nielsen is this year's winner of the Coretta Scott King Authors Award for Children's Books. He was kind enough to join us by phone from his home office in Los Angeles. Crystal Carr-Jeter is the chair of the King Awards Committee for the American Library Association, and she was kind enough to join us from Dallas, Texas. Thanks to you both so much for joining us, and congratulations once again, Kadir Nielsen.
Thank you
very much. Thanks for having us.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms in your corner. Every week, we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy advice. And today, we are talking about a topic that's very serious for a lot of parents: how their children play and what they play with. Now, I think it's fair to say that many of us grew up with the idea, or at least we were given the idea, that girls played dress up or with dolls, while things like toy guns or cars or blocks were for boys. Now, the company that makes Legos is challenging that with sets of blocks made especially for girls. The new line is called Friends, and here's a clip from an ad promoting it.
Drive by Olivia's house. past the vet with all the pets to the newly built cafe. We're here. Let's all help out. Make burgers, shakes, bake the cupcakes, and we're open. Our first customer. It's perfect. Welcome to the world of Lego Friends. New Lego Friends.
Now, Lego says their research showed that parents and their daughters wanted toys like these, but some critics say these toys with their shopping and primping Lego characters are teaching girls all the wrong lessons. Last week, I spoke with freelance writer Bailey Shoemaker Richard. She's a young woman who was so offended by these new toys that she started an online petition against them, and here's what she had to say.
It's very focused on hanging out, on appearance, on beauty shops, and it's a very narrow and limiting sort of idea of what girlhood Lego experience should be.
Now, Bailey went on to say that she's already gotten 45,000 signatures on her online petition. And we also got a lot of comments after that conversation. Some applauded the company for bringing girls into the fold, but others felt that the new Legos focused too much on stereotypes of women. So who better to talk about this than our moms panel? And I'm joined now by Sarah Mazes. She is the mom of three. That includes two girls. And she also has boy-girl twins who are 8 years old. She writes a blog called Mommy Light Online. Carrie Goldman is a mom of three girls. She also has a blog. It's called Portrait of an Adoption. And Rupa Unakrishnan is the mom of 8.5-year-old twins. You know that half is very important, a boy and a girl, as am I. And welcome to you all. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Hey, Michelle.
Thank you.
Hello.
Now, Sarah, do I have this right? You also used to work in the toy industry, correct?
I did. I worked at Mattel, and I have worked on Barbie.
Okay, and you've worked on Barbie, a Barbie person. Now, you told us that you think the people who say they're offended by Lego are being, and I'm quoting here, ridiculous, and that you are standing up for your daughter's right to their girliness. Tell us what you mean by that.
There are a few things that will make me really, you know, just get passionate and dig my heels in, and this is one of them. And I just feel like, I don't know if it's because I've read a lot lately in the news about parents who are encouraging gender-neutral children. They don't even reveal the gender of their children. But having boys and girls, I can tell you that innately, they have different play patterns. Their role models are different. What they want to play with is different. And to deny that, I think, is extracting from a child the ability to create an identity. And it just drives me insane when people dig their heels into the ground and say, you have to allow a girl the opportunity to play with gender-neutral toys. You have to allow them the opportunity to explore who they are. And I completely agree. But what if who they are is girly?
So in a way, you're saying, like, if people are saying when you hear gender neutral, what you really say, what you're really hearing is be like a boy and play with what boys want, and boys are kind of the norm. Is that kind of it fit into the boy context?
That's part of it. I'm hearing be like a boy. I'm hearing deny your sex. That's what I'm hearing. And that's what's frustrating.
All right. Tell us how you really feel, Sarah. Maybe you'll come out of your shell later in the program. Now, Carrie, your daughter's story made national headlines about a year ago.
International. Yeah.
Because you wrote about this. She was teased for carrying a Star Wars water bottle to school by kids who told her that Star Wars was only for boys. But despite that, you have a beef with these new Lego products. Tell us how you feel about this.
Well, obviously the counterpoint to Sarah. I'm one of the moms who believes that the stereotype in the marketing is offensive. And there's an important distinction, however. I don't have a problem with the pink blocks or with creating Legos that appeal to some of the interests that have not been represented so far in Legos. My problem is that they're marketing it as those interests have to be the realm of the girls. And so what happens is you have girls who are being told, you have to play with the beauty set. You have to play with the cafe. And then if you want to play with the engineering sets or this and that, you have to walk over to the regular, you know, the boy aisle to get those. And you create situations where kids who are pretty susceptible to marketing messages, they observe this and they listen. And then you have boys who see girls like my daughter and say, oh, no. You can't play with the Harry Potters or the Star Wars sets because those are the boys' sets. And it can lead to bullying and other problems. And it actually goes both ways because I've also seen boys express an interest in playing with some of these cafes or beauty parlors. And now they're being taunted because they're being told that stuff is for girls. You're a sissy. So I think it's great to offer a full range of Lego products. I think it's great to offer a beauty, you know, a beauty products and whatnot, but just put them all in one place. Don't gender label them. Don't say these are for the girls, these are for the boys. You know, definitely put all different kinds of products out there and then let the kids choose.
Rupa, where are you on this?
I'd sort of come right in the middle. No, I'd say that I'm a little further from Sarah in that I'd say that my vision is a little more integrated. I have to tell you, I'm one of those people who grew up rifle shooting in India, right? So it's not normal, but it just felt normal to me in the sense of there wasn't a sense that that's not what girls do in our household. And I suspect that part of this, what sort of irks some of us about these pink, you know, hairdresser and vet shop kind of toys is that it doesn't allow for integration. What I'd love for Lego to do is to say, okay, so we have this line for the girl who really does want to be, you know, to gravitate there. But there are the girls like mine who would like to see more female Jedi characters in the sky, you know, the Star Wars pack, right? I think that's what the inherent need is. They have this broader range of Wii games, for example, and they have now this series on TV called Ninjago, and it sort of irks me and irks my daughter, who's 8 and a half, and who said, that's really unfortunate that this character, the girl character, is just standing there screaming for help and has to pretend to be some sort of mysterious character and not let her ninja out. That's how she actually phrased it. And so this sort of sense of shame in being integrated into being a ninja is kind of what sort of permeates here.
So the whole thing that boys are active, girls are passive.
Yeah.
And you feel it kind of reinforces this idea, even if the girl is not. And if you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about why it is that toys seem to still be marketed mainly for boys or for girls. Is that okay? Is that not okay? And what sparked our conversation was a conversation we had earlier about Legos, which has brought out a new line of blocks for girls, which sparked an online petition protesting it. And I'm joined by Rupa Unnikrishnan. That's who was speaking just now. She's a mom of 8 and a half-year-old twins. Carrie Goldman is a mom of 3 girls, and she's a blogger. And Sarah Mazes is also a mom of 3. She also has boy-girl twins, and she also blogs. Let's bring in a comment. You know, we ask listeners, you know, what do you think about this? I'll give you a comment from one of our listeners, Alex Hardberger, who called our comment line, and this is what he had to say.
Yes, there is a stereotype that it is buying into so that Lego can sell more Legos and make more money, but it's not a stereotype they created, and it's not their job to break it.
Well, Carrie, what about that? Why don't you weigh in on that?
Well, it's funny. Yes, I actually wrote an article called Dear Lego, I Have a Girl, and he commented, it's not a stereotype they created. And that's where I disagree. You know, if you spend years and years putting Legos in a boy aisle, and in those sets are adventure toys and Star Wars toys, and you leave girls out of a lot of your marketing, and you've had a stated marketing strategy that has said you're targeting boys, how can you turn around and say you haven't created the stereotype when now you realize, oh, wait, you know, we're missing, as they put it, 50% of the population. We want to target them now. And you roll out, you know, the hair dryers and the beauty cafes. Well, then you have created the stereotype. Well, and now you're trying to profit from the stereotype.
Sarah, what do you think about that?
I'm sorry. I have to say, I feel like they haven't created the stereotype. There's a stereotype, I believe, and I know I'm going to take so much heat for this. There's a stereotype that exists. There, for the most part, we are natural beings, and I just can't help but feel like so much of this, for a lot of us, I'm not saying for everyone, is programmed into our DNA, certain role-playing. I mean, having worked at a toy company like Mattel, and having sat in on focus groups and spoken with parents and spoken with children, and also seeing my own kids, boys and girls, their natural proclivity towards cars and my girls towards role play, it's so innate, we can't fight it. I definitely agree that there is, how much are the toy companies playing into it? On top of that, how much are the toy stores where the toy companies actually have to sell into and fit onto the aisles play into it? This is a huge issue that extends way beyond the parents' pocketbook, way beyond the marketers at the toy companies. This is a huge conversation, and it is not.
So you're saying, like, okay. So what's so terrible? It's not. Yeah, is it their job to change 2,000 years of social history?
So exactly. That's no. Go ahead.
Sarah, let Rupa.
Okay. So this is Rupa, and maybe, you know, Sarah, you threw the gauntlet down. Maybe I'll take it up gently.
Good.
In that, I think there are three ways to think about it. One is, you know, you see, you know, truly responsible TV making, you know, TV programming done by companies that actually go in and bring a child psychologist, an anthropologist, a linguist into play just to make sure that they are not underscoring and the stereotype that exists out there. Because to some extent, a company like, so point two, a company like Lego has some amount of responsibility in trying to help a parent in bringing up children in a sort of a more balanced environment than the 2,000 years of stereotyping has developed. And the third
let me get in this. Yeah. We'll finish your thought, then I want to ask you something.
So I think the third element, though, which I think is in keeping with what that statement was, the quote is, it is actually my job as a parent to actually make the decision. So I will not be going out and buying that toy. And when the Legos, when the kids were younger, I went out and very consciously found a company that build more neutral toys. It's called Zolo, and it has nothing that sort of suggests that this is a boy's toy. So I think, you know, it is at the end, it's up to the parent to drive and design the child's experience.
Let me ask Rupa this. Hold on, let me jump in.
This is Carrie.
No. Let me get into this. Rupa, you have a business background, okay?
Yes.
So the question I have for you is, why do you say that it is Lego's responsibility to enforce any particular set of values other than the one that the marketplace will bear?
Right. Well, so it is a question that you can look at it both ways. One is, you have a responsibility. I mean, I've come from a couple of industries where they take their responsibilities really seriously. Healthcare and sort of, you know, mutual funds, where, you know, you really do want to make sure that the outcome is what your client needs and wants. So that's one. And if Lego's hearing that the client just needs girly girls, well, there you go. That's a decision they made. But secondly, it's also about slicing and dicing what the sort of future looks like to some extent. And if I'm not going to be spending money on this, and if they actually have decided that they don't want my demographic, that's great. But guess what?
Totally,
they don't have my demographic.
Money on this.
Okay, Carrie, what did you want to say?
Great. Well, I just wanted to say,
Carrie Goldman.
Yes. If you read the book from Lise Elliott, which is called Pink Brain, Blue Brain, you'll see that, yes, Sarah, it's true. Developmental psychologists have shown that toy choice among young children does have some stereotypes, that studies have shown that boys do gravitate towards masculine toys and girls towards more feminine toys. But what her point is that it's not about nature or nurture, but how, as Peggy Orenstein wrote in an article recently, nurture becomes nature. And so if we just pander to these differences and we say, yep, you're going to choose dolls, you're going to choose balls, and we let them do that, we miss out on an opportunity in these early years when their brains are so malleable to actually contradict their natural tendencies and promote some cross-sex toys, plays, friendships. And there's evidence that children who do play with these cross-sex toys actually do better down the road in leadership functions in the world.
Carrie, before we let you go, I just have to ask you, how did the Star Wars thing play out? What happened?
Oh, well, that's, yeah, sure. The way it played out is that we had to have some major bullying-related interventions. I'm writing a book that's coming out in August by HarperCollins that's called Bullied. And it's about how bullying has basically evolved in our culture. And not a small part of it is an exploration of stereotypes and how gender stereotypes in particular lead to these types of activities.
Well, come back and tell us about the book. But what happened with the Star Wars water bottle? Did I understand that she actually got a lot of good Star Wars swag out of this, because a lot of people were saying,
did.
I don't think so. I don't think so. What was the best thing that happened?
She received a lot of great things happened. You know, she got sent lightsabers and she received all kinds of Jedi toys. And we made friends, most importantly, with a lot of what are called geek girls. And those are girls who have interests in science, technology, math, gaming. And they've been very verbal in their support of girls like Katie who are not necessarily mainstream.
Okay, well, come back and tell us about the book when that comes back. I hope that's a date. But finally, we only have about a minute left, so I want to hear from each of you on this question. Look, lots of men are nurses. Many women are soldiers and service members serving in uniform, you know, on the front lines. Do you envision a day when we'll see that reflected in toys? And I'll go around. Sarah, how about
this
you?
This is Sarah.
Sarah?
Until there is a mass request for it from the consumer, I don't think we'll see as much of it reflected. And it's not that I wouldn't look for a gender-neutral toy. I have pushed gender-neutral toys on my children their whole lives. But all I can do, and this is sort of in response to the Peggy Orenstein thing and about nurturing, is that all nurturing can do is inhibit or facilitate what's already a natural behavior.
Okay. All right. Let's hear from everybody on this. So your boys are still grabbing Barbies and using them and pretending they're pistols. So, and shooting people with their feet. Okay, Rupa, very quickly.
Yeah, I'd love for there to be more, right? Because I have to go to the specialty, you know, Upper West Side store to get the European toy, which costs about 40% more than I would if I went to Toys R Us. So I would love there to be more. And I think that would change the dynamic,
okay.
Just accessibility.
Carrie, final thought?
I think Sarah's right that without a mass request, we probably won't see it. But that's why we have the opportunity to educate people and try and, you know, persuade people to think with different ways.
All right. Carrie Goldman is a mom of three girls and she blogs. She was with us from member station WBEZ in Chicago. Sarah Mazes is a mom of three, a 12-year-old daughter and also 8-year-old twins. She was with us from NPR West in Culver City, California. And Rupa Unnikrishnan is the mom of 8.5-year-old twins, a boy and a girl. She was with us from NPR's Bureau in New York. Ladies, moms, thank you so much.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thanks, everyone. Bye. Thanks, everyone.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.